female comics are talking about their experiences. It's called Shitty Statistics, Black Women in Comedy, Dark Humor. Check it out on YouTube. I'm signing out. It is 4:59, and I'm your girl, Miss Ben, and this is Heal Black Girl Heal. Do know that you can always check out the archives on ckut.ca if you missed out. I will be right here, same time, same place next week from 3 to 5. So keep it locked.
Calling me a racist, sending me.
You look at me like I'm unfamiliar. Acting brand new like you never knew that you like them thick. I've been carrying this weight in a world beneath these braids, and I'm confused. Would you take the pain that came with all the parts you wanna claim for you? You want my thighs, you want my stride, but not this melanin. You want my hair, but
choosing to leave until they officially resign. We'll go to Colombo to speak with one of the protesters. Then, the Pentagon authorizes another $400 million for the fight in Ukraine, bringing total U.S. security spending on Ukraine under President Biden to some $8 billion. We'll speak with Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, about the pressure on independent media to follow a single approved narrative on the Ukraine war.
The mainstream media has been, in many ways, whitewashing the causes and the historical context of the war, which in no way justifies what has happened in Ukraine. However, because we have reported that, we've become subject to reviews and attacks by government-linked organizations, including NewsGuard, and PayPal has shut us down. And we've also had British government officials looking into us. So this is a very chilling moment for free press, I believe.
And as calls grow for President Biden to declare a public health emergency to ensure access to abortion after the Supreme Court overturned Roe, we'll get an update from two leading abortion providers in southern states.
Alabama was the first state to pass a complete, total, no exceptions abortion ban. Then it was one of the first states to close all of its doors once the Supreme Court decision came down and overturned Roe v. Wade. Now we're expecting it to be the first state where people are going to test what does it mean to aid and abet somebody when getting an abortion.
We'll speak with Robin Marty, author of the new handbook for post-Roe America. She's operations director of the West Alabama Women's Center, which just reopened Monday. And with Diane Derzis, CEO of Jackson Women's Health Organization, the clinic at the center of the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Ukraine, the death toll from a Russian rocket attack Sunday on an apartment block in the Donetsk town of Chasiv Yar has risen to 33. Rescue crews pulled 9 survivors from the wreckage. Let's see if there's more right now on what's happening. Rescue crews pulled the 9 survivors. Elsewhere in Ukraine, Ukraine says 5 people were killed, including 2 children, and dozens more injured after Russian shells fell on Kharkiv. In Washington, D.C., the Biden administration accused Russia of turning to Iran with a request for hundreds of weapons-capable drones for use in Ukraine. In Kyiv, the Communist Party of Ukraine and other left parties report they've been banned and had their assets seized under a decree by President Vladimir Zelensky, prohibiting political parties deemed to be pro-Russian. In Moscow, President Putin said he would expedite the procedure for Ukrainians to obtain Russian citizenship. Ukrainian officials condemned the move, calling it an encroachment on Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. On Monday, a top Ukrainian official said some 7,200 military personnel are missing and unaccounted for, though most are believed to be in Russian captivity. We'll get the latest on the war in Ukraine later in the broadcast. The Biden administration said Monday U.S. physicians must provide abortions if a pregnant person is experiencing a medical emergency and their life is at risk. In a letter to federal health agencies, Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said doctors who offer the procedure in states with abortion bans would be protected under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which is federal law. Becerra warned hospitals and physicians who refuse to provide abortions under these circumstances would face the loss of Medicare funding and financial support from other state health programs. In Michigan, reproductive justice advocates have formally submitted over 700,000 signatures in support of a ballot initiative that would enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution. The measure would be up for a vote in November. We'll have the latest on the fight over reproductive rights in the U.S. later in the broadcast. In Texas, hundreds of protesters marched through the streets of Uvalde Sunday, braving triple-digit temperatures to demand answers over the May 24th massacre at Robb Elementary School that left 19 fourth graders and their two teachers dead. Joining the protest was Alessandra Garcia, whose mother, Irma, was one of the teachers killed in the attack.
She was kind and loving. She had a way with words. She was the backbone to our family. And we will never be the same. As sad as it is, a part of me knew my mother would give her life to save her students.
Alessandra Garcia's father, Joe, died of a heart attack 2 days after his wife, Irma, was killed by the Uvalde shooter. At the White House, the parent of a student killed in a 2018 mass shooting interrupted President Biden Monday to demand more federal action on gun control. Biden was holding the ceremony in the Rose Garden, with survivors and family members affected by gun violence celebrating a signature of a bipartisan gun safety bill. When Manuel Oliver rose to challenge Biden's record on guns, Oliver lost his 17-year-old son, Joaquin, to a mass shooter at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, Valentine's Day, 2018.
Today's many things is proof that despite the naysayers, we can make meaningful progress on dealing with gun violence. Because make no mistake, sit down, you'll hear what I have to say. If you think you.
I've been trying to tell you this for years.
Let me finish my comment. Let him talk. Let him talk. No one. Okay?
Manny Oliver was then escorted away by Secret Service agents after the confrontation. He told reporters he's demanding Biden create an office in the executive branch focused solely on gun violence.
What am I supposed to do today here? Listen to a package of bills that don't solve 100% a problem that is killing people every single day in America? Clap and be happy and be part of a celebration? Not me. We got a fancy invitation from the White House. It was like going to a wedding. And I'm here. I thought that I needed to be here. But I also needed to say what I said.
He was wearing a T-shirt with a picture of his son, Guac, on it. Public health officials are warning of a fast-spreading new coronavirus variant that's been linked to a growing number of cases across India. The BA.2.75 variant evolved from the highly contagious Omicron lineage and appears to be outcompeting rival forms of the virus. This comes as the BA.5 Omicron subvariant now accounts for a majority of cases in the United States, where COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to rise and test positivity rates have climbed to their third-worst levels of the pandemic. Meanwhile, Democratic leaders are delaying action in the Senate, where the two senators, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, are absent after testing positive for coronavirus. Blumenthal announced his diagnosis Monday after returning from a trip to Ukraine, where he met with President Volodymyr Zelensky and other top officials. In Sri Lanka, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa has reportedly made a failed attempt to flee the country ahead of his resignation for Wednesday. Agence France-Presse reports the president may now use a Navy patrol boat to flee the island nation, which is facing a major economic crisis, and saw thousands of protesters storm the president's home Saturday and set fire to the prime minister's residence. Rajapaksa is immune from arrest while he's still president and may be trying to leave in order to avoid being detained. He's accused of war crimes during his time as defense minister and of bankrupting Sri Lanka with massive corruption and economic management that's left millions of people with shortages of food, fuel and electricity. In the capital, Colombo, restaurants use firewood to prepare meals Monday.
We cook using wood. There is no cooking gas here. It has been 15 days, and the authorities said the cooking gas would be made available, but it has not arrived yet.
After headlines, we'll go to Colombo, Sri Lanka, for the latest. President Biden departs for Jerusalem this evening, the first stop in his four-day trip to the Middle East. After meeting with Israeli leaders, Biden's scheduled to meet with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank before going to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. As a presidential candidate, Biden vowed to make Saudi Arabia pariah over its human rights violations and the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. This week, Reuters reported the Biden administration's discussing the possible lifting of its ban on U.S. sales of so-called offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia, including Lockheed Martin F-35 jets. Biden put the ban in place early last year, citing the Saudi-led coalition's disastrous war in Yemen, which has killed more than 100,000 people since 2015. In immigration news, the Biden administration's extended temporary protected status, TPS, for Venezuelans for another 18 months. This designation only protects Venezuelans who've been in the United States since March 2021. Venezuelan asylum seekers who've come to the U.S. after March 8, 2021, are not eligible for the temporary humanitarian relief and face deportation. Tens of thousands of Venezuelans have fled due to rising shortages of food and medicine and other conditions that have been largely exacerbated by harsh U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. This comes as the Biden administration also continues to mass expel thousands of asylum seekers from Haiti, Central America, and other regions arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border under the Trump-era pandemic policy, Title 42. And First Lady Jill Biden's facing massive backlash after saying Latinx people are, quote, as unique as breakfast tacos. Biden made her remarks Monday during an annual conference hosted by the group Unidos U.S. in San Antonio, Texas.
The diversity of this community, as distinct as the Bogotas of the Bronx, as beautiful as the blossoms of Miami, and as unique as the breakfast tacos here in San Antonio.
The National Association of Hispanic Journalists, NAHJ, responded in a statement, quote, we are not tacos. Our heritage as Latinos is shaped by a variety of diasporas, cultures, and food traditions, and should not be reduced to a stereotype, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And people should read your book, The Harvest of Empire, The History of Latinos in America, to understand the diversity and the enormous, rich history of the Latinx population in this country, Juan. Well, we begin today's show in Sri Lanka, where President Gotabaya Rajapaksa has reportedly made a failed attempt to flee the country ahead of his resignation set for Wednesday. Agence France-Presse reports the president may now use a Navy patrol craft to flee the island nation, which is facing a major economic crisis and saw thousands of protesters storm the president's home Saturday and set fire to the prime minister's residence. Protesters are still occupying the president's home until he formally resigns. Rajapaksa is immune from arrest while he's still present, may be trying to leave in order to avoid being detained. He's accused of bankrupting Sri Lanka with massive corruption, economic mismanagement, and also of war crimes during his time as defense minister. After his resignation, an interim all-party unity government is expected to lead the country. Sri Lanka's parliament will meet Friday, and a new president is set to be elected by the members of the parliament next week. For more, we go to the capital, Colombo, to speak with Bhavani Fonseca, a human rights lawyer, senior researcher at the Center for Policy Alternatives in Colombo. She's been participating in the protests. Her recent article is headlined, Sri Lanka's Crisis and the Power of Citizen Mobilization. Welcome to Democracy Now! Bhavani, thank you so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about how these protests began. Now the protesters occupying the prime minister's and the president's home demanding both resign. Talk about the power of citizen protest.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. I mean, Sri Lanka is facing quite the remarkable period. At one level, we have an unprecedented political and economic crisis. But at another, we've seen citizens peacefully protesting for months, asking for change, a change in political culture, a change in the political leadership, and basically political accountability. So there is a real reawakening of the citizen, and it's quite remarkable to see the numbers that have come out to the streets peacefully protesting over the months. But what was even more remarkable was the numbers that came out on Saturday, on the 9th of July. And this was in a context where many don't have fuel to travel. So many walked for hours to get to the protest site, and they occupied the protest site. And unlike the other days of protests, they were able to enter the presidential secretariat, the presidential palace, and the official residence of the prime minister. And they are now occupying these spaces till the president resigns and the prime minister resigns. But so it's quite dynamic and fluid days in Sri Lanka, but it's all centered in this backdrop of citizens' mobilization and the citizen, the power of the people to bring in change.
And Bhavani Fonseca, if you could talk a little bit about the roots of the crisis. There's a lot of international press coverage of what's happening now, but there has been little attention to how the crisis evolved, and especially in terms of whatever financial debt the country owes to outsiders. There was an International Monetary Fund group that visited the country in at the end of June.
Yes, so Sri Lanka is in heavy debt, and that goes back, it predates this government, the government of Gotabaya Rajapaksa. The debt is really going back to different governments, and the debt has got to a point where now Sri Lanka is facing bankruptcy, and they announced a default a couple of months ago. So it really, there is massive debt, but also it's related to the mismanagement of this government. Now, in 2019 onwards, after Gotabaya Rajapaksa took office, there's been several policy decisions that led to this present crisis. One was the tax cuts in 2019 that significantly impacted the revenue of the government. In 2021, there was an overnight ban on chemical fertilizer, which has impacted the agriculture sector and food security. And of course, we had the challenges with the COVID, the pandemic, but also more recently with the Ukraine-Russian war. So those have also impacted. But largely, it's been domestic policies and mismanagement of this government, which has led to an economic crisis. And now we are facing also a political crisis and political instability. So all this has resulted in a situation where many in Sri Lanka are facing severe hardships, getting essential items, long power cuts, long queues to get fuel. I mean, we are at the moment having long queues that where people have to stay for days, 3-4 days, just to get some petrol and diesel. So that is the hardship that faced by many people, and it's impacted most in Sri Lanka. And it has resulted in extreme anger and frustration among the people. So the public mobilization demanding for accountability, demanding for change, stems from this economic crisis and the mismanagement. But now it's become a political crisis as well. So it's a combined situation in Sri Lanka. And now it's also, there is a situation where we are seeing an unfolding humanitarian crisis. So multiple challenges on the ground.
Now, both the president and the prime minister have said they will resign, but they have not yet done so. How do you see events unfolding over the next few days? And who is most likely to run a caretaker government?
So this is a very worrying dynamic. You know, you would think with all the people peacefully protesting and all the developments over the last few days, but over the last few months, really, that the message would be, it would be clear that they're asking for the resignation of the president and they're asking for the resignation of the prime minister. Now, I would have thought any government would have heard this message and resigned immediately. But we are at a situation where the president has said he will resign tomorrow.
Bhavani Fonseca, I'm looking at an article by Reuters, how a band of activists helped bring down Sri Lanka's government. It says, in June, a few dozen activists started meeting regularly at a seaside tented camp in Colombo for hours-long sessions to think up ways to revive Sri Lanka's flagging protest movement. The group, which included a Catholic priest, a digital strategist, and a popular playwright, succeeded beyond their wildest hopes. Within weeks, hundreds of thousands of people descended on Colombo. After initially clashing with police, protesters occupied key government buildings and residences, forcing President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his prime minister to promise to step down. So what is your assessment? Would you agree this band of activists, the Catholic priest, digital strategist, popular playwright, gathering together, and soon hundreds of thousands of people are now occupying the prime minister and president's residence and demanding they resign?
Well, it's quite remarkable what we're seeing, you know, different sectors, communities coming together. I mean, this we have not seen in Sri Lanka's past, and Sri Lanka has a rich history of protests. But this kind of mobilization is quite unique. And the fact that the protests have been there for now several months, this is not something that just happened in the last couple of days, but over the months, people have persistently come out and largely peacefully coming out and demanding for change. So that's quite something. And the result is, in May, we had the then prime minister resigning. In April, we had the cabinet resigning. So we saw results. But we also have seen the president holding on to office despite all the protests, despite the clear message for him to go home. So now with the announcement that the president is going to leave on Wednesday the 13th, we hope that he keeps to his word, because if he doesn't leave, there will be further instability. But his resignation alone is not going to satisfy the protesters and the people of Sri Lanka. They are asking for the resignation of the prime minister as well, and that there is a new caretaker government that happens. And we need to also think of next steps. You know, a caretaker government can serve a particular time period, but considering the crisis and considering the demands of the people that there has to be a change, we need to look to general elections as soon as the environment is conducive to have elections. So a lot of things are on the table. A lot of things I hope can move forward in terms of addressing the present crisis and ensuring their stability.
I want to thank you, Bhavani Fonseca, for being with us, human rights lawyer and senior researcher at the Center for Policy Alternatives in Colombo, participating in the protests. We'll link to your article, Sri Lanka's Crisis and the Power of Citizen Mobilization. Of course, continue to follow what's happening in Sri Lanka. As the Pentagon authorizes another $400 million for the fight in Ukraine, after break, we will go to Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, about the pressure on independent media to follow a single approved narrative on the Ukraine war. Stay with us.
All highways blocked off, no exits, no shortcuts. Them white flags been bloodbath, that bloodshed's been soaked up. Squeezed out, poured back in my cup, I toast up. Then drink back my bloodline, they try bite my culture. They started telling us lies, selling them lies, shelling hospitals, getting by on a daily basis while they murder my people underneath the nose of every Pinocchio politician, news channel, anchorman, department of police, the whole UN, the whole system they say was made to serve us, huh? Okay, cool story, okay. Never trust no pig's word. Never. Them lawmakers, all bakers, bottom line is cake first. They burnt down our library on that night in June. Them fools had no clue our history is so fireproof. So tell me now, how do I show any mercy when knowing that they would have put me up under a body bag? Body been missing and nobody looking except for the mothers who want it back. This is the part that be getting me wildin', cause now they be telling this island is something for tourists and telling them this is some heavenly marvelous pearl of the Indian tropical vacation getaway. Welcome to paradise. Welcome to paradise. On your left hand side, if you look, you'll see 5-star resorts built with mass graves beneath the breezes. So crisp, the views
to die for. Coming up on my right, we have here what we call the field of 100,000 flowers. One for each soul missing with no answers. Their ancestors to serve as a witness to what they saw when the cameras turned off and the killing field started.
100,000 flowers by the Sri Lankan musician Sean Vincent de Paul. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As U.S. President Joe Biden is set to visit with leaders in Israel and Saudi Arabia this week, the Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin will travel to Tehran next week to meet with presidents of Iran and Turkey for peace talks on Syria and also to hold separate talks with the Turkish President Erdogan, who's offered to mediate between Russia and Ukraine. This comes as White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed Monday Iran plans to supply Russia with potentially hundreds of drones for its war in Ukraine.
Our information indicates that the Iranian government is preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred UAVs, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Our information further indicates that Iran is preparing to train Russian forces to use these UAVs, with initial training sessions slated to begin as soon as early July. It's unclear whether Iran has delivered any of these UAVs to Russia already.
Sullivan vowed the United States will continue to sustain its defense of Ukraine. His comments come after the Pentagon on Friday authorized another $400 million for the fight in Ukraine. This brings the total U.S. security assistance to Ukraine in the last 3 weeks alone to $2.2 billion. Under President Biden, the U.S. has committed at least $8 billion overall to Ukraine. For more, we're joined by Joe Luria, editor-in-chief of the independent news outlet Consortium News, also a former U.N. correspondent and investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, Sunday Times of London. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Joe. If you can start off by talking about the latest situation in Ukraine and what you think is missing from the mainstream news coverage.
Oh, there's plenty missing. Thank you. First of all, thanks for having me on to talk about this, Amy. Plenty missing from the mainstream media coverage of this from the initial part of this invasion until today. Mostly, we have seen reporting in the corporate media based solely on U.S. officials or Ukrainian officials. So we're getting only one side of the story. And obviously, that's pretty much journalism 101, that there's more than one side of the story. So American and European audiences have been fed the idea that Russia has been failing in this war and that Ukraine still has a chance to win. But I think we're starting to see reality seep into the reporting. When you've got somebody like Henry Kissinger saying that Ukraine is going to have to make territorial concessions, when the Pope says that NATO was barking at Russia's door, we start to see that, in fact, it wasn't the simple story that we're being told every day. And the reporting on the ground is very difficult. We shy away from it, because both sides lie in wars. When both sides admit an event happened, and then you can pretty much be assured that it happened. And now there's pretty much a consensus emerging that Russia is close to taking all of Donbass, which was their initial aim in this war. So we're starting somewhat to see that kind of reporting, but still we cannot trust what the Western media is reporting. We cannot trust whatever the Russian Defense Ministry says necessarily either. So I think that we have to hope that the mainstream media will begin to take a more balanced view. But I'm not holding my breath about that.
Well, Joe, I wanted to ask you in terms of the roots of the conflict. I've been really impressed by a lot of the coverage that Consortium News has been producing from people who used to be covered a lot by folks on the left, like Scott Ritter and John Kiriakou and Caitlin Johnston and Jeffrey Sachs, but are now sort of ignored because they're not going along with the main narrative. But there was an interesting piece that came out in the New York Times in July, 5 months into the war, which says the headline is Commando Network Coordinates Flow on Weapons in Ukraine. And deep in that story, there's this amazing fact thrown in, and I want to quote it. From 2015 to early this year, American Special Forces and National Guard instructors trained more than 27,000 Ukrainian soldiers at the Yavoriv Combat Training Center in western Ukraine near the city of Lviv, Pentagon officials said. This is the first time I hear of this enormous training operation that was going on inside Ukraine by U.S. soldiers for the last 7 years. So if you could talk about this whole issue of Ukraine not being in NATO, but effectively being a U.S. ally now for years.
Yeah, it's a de facto member of NATO. That's very clear. This wasn't just the United States. There are other NATO nations that were training Ukrainian troops and arming Ukraine even before this massive inflow of weapons that we've seen since February. So, I mean, this is not lost, obviously, on Russia. Since the coup in 2014, Russia has seen a buildup of what they see as anti-Russian government backed by the United States with this NATO training and weaponizing of the country. And I think that this is just the latest development, that the CIA has been involved in Ukraine since the late 1940s when they worked with Mikhail Lebed, who was the right-hand man of Stefan Bandera, the World War II-era Ukrainian fascist leader, to undermine the Soviet Union. And that never stopped, really. The U.S. has been deeply involved in Ukraine, and this comes as no surprise with the New York Times reported. I think we already knew pretty much that this was going on, that, in fact, NATO, while Ukraine is not a member of NATO, it is has been and is a de facto member of NATO today.
And you mentioned the coup in 2014. The founder of Consortium News, a legendary investigative reporter, Bob Perry, did a lot of coverage on that. And could you talk about how that has informed the way you Consortium News looks at the current crisis?
Oh, very much so. Bob was way ahead of the game on Ukraine. He even wrote a piece back in 2015 in which he warned about a nuclear war over Ukraine. I thought it was a bit over the top at the time, but now we see what the situation. We're probably closer to a possible nuclear exchange than we've been, certainly since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So Bob understood, and he got a lot of flack for this. It started back then. It's much worse now against Consortium News. But he pointed out that the U.S. was working with extreme right groups, neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine to help overthrow a democratically elected, albeit corrupt, but I don't think there's hardly a politician in Ukraine who cannot be called that, to overthrow Viktor Yanukovych, who the OSCE, by the way, certified his election in 2010. And the United States helped install leaders that were absolutely anti-Russian and accommodated these right extreme right groups, and then launched a war against the Donbass because the Russian ethnic speakers there on the Russian border objected to this coup. Their president that they voted for was overthrown, and they declared independence from Ukraine, and the response backed by the U.S. was to begin a civil war in which thousands of people have been killed over the last 8 years. That's something that's completely excised from the reporting today. It was that war that Russia entered, really, in February of this year to try to put down that rebellion and to do a lot more, no question about that. Russia's aims were still not clear exactly what they are, but they're certainly beyond Donbass, although that is what they've concentrated on in the last few months. So Bob Perry was way ahead of the reporting on Ukraine, and he kind of paved the way and informed me. I started working for Consortium News in 2011, but my understanding of Ukraine was certainly influenced very much by Bob's factual reporting about what was going on, despite the attacks he came under. And that, as I said, have only increased dramatically since February of this year.
Joe Lauria, in May, PayPal canceled the account and froze the funds of your independent news outlet of Consortium. What happened, and what effect has it had on Consortium News?
Well, we thank PayPal for doing that, because the effect has been an enormous influx of money. We had our best spring fund drive in our history, and people have shown enormous support for what PayPal did. And we don't really know exactly why, because they refused to tell us the reason why. They did release their funds after Matt Taibbi wrote a piece about it in his Substack, and the New York Post even picked up on that. So we got our money back, but the issue is we are completely banned from PayPal, and we don't know why. The only reasons we can assume is because we trade in information, not in banned drug paraphernalia or arms, which you cannot sell over PayPal. And in their user agreement, restricted activities include purveying misinformation to third parties. So clearly, I think this has to do with our coverage of the Ukraine war. And what has been our coverage of the Ukraine war, but to talk about the causes of the war and the historical context, which is completely missing from the mainstream reporting. You know, historians will talk about the causes of World War II and the rise of Nazism. They often will point to the Versailles Treaty and the onerous conditions it imposed on Germany. And nobody accuses those historians of being Hitler apologists. But when we talk in real time now about the causes of this unfortunate conflict and avoidable conflict, we are smeared as Kremlin agents and as Putin puppets and all of this complete nonsense. We saw in the gray zone leaked emails that a government official, some from the Foreign Office, was looking into us, that Nina Jankovic, who was the head of the short-lived governance disinformation governance board, a chilling Orwellian board that the Biden administration set up, she said we were useful idiots. We weren't funded, presumably by hostile power. You know, we're seeing, Amy, if you recall, during the Vietnam War, Americans who justly protested the murderous policies of their government were smeared as puppets of Hanoi or Beijing or Moscow. It's the oldest trick in the book for governments to smear out legitimate critics of their policies as foreign stooges. And we're insulted by that because it takes our agency away from us, as if we can't think on our own. So they're trying to crush the smallest spark of dissent. Because conservative news, we have about 10,000 readers a day. It briefly went up to 40,000 at the beginning of the war. Why? Because we were providing the historical context, the causes of the war, NATO expansion, the rejection of the Russian treaties back in December to NATO and the U.S. to create a security, new security architecture in Europe, the failure to implement the Donetsk, Minsk Accords, sorry, in Donbass. And, of course, when you remove all of those causes, it looks like Russia is just a madman and only an imperialist. Now, while it's true, Putin has talked over the years about Nova Russia, founded by Catherine the Great in the 18th century, that it was basically an integral part of Russia. If you remove all these other causes, he just looks like some imperial madman. And the invasion of Ukraine pales in comparison, of course, with the invasion of Iraq and Panama and Grenada by the United States, all of which, none of which have had Security Council authorization, including Russia. So it is technically an illegal invasion. So we are in a situation now where because we report these causes, we're being smeared and attacked and deplatformed, and PayPal won't let us raise money through them. But as I said, we're doing quite well without them. Thank you very much.
And could you talk about this organization, NewsGuard, and how they are targeting you? Who exactly is NewsGuard?
Yeah, NewsGuard started in 2 or 3 years ago. It's a private company based in New York. On its board is Michael Hayden, who was a former CIA and NSA director, a former NATO Secretary General Rasmussen, Tom Ridge, the first Homeland Security director. They have partnerships with the Pentagon and with the State Department. They have taken it upon themselves. Stephen Brill was one of the founders of it, who back in the 90s had the magazine Brill's Content. They take it upon themselves to review news organizations, large and small, from the New York Times to Consortium News. And they have announced that they, or wrote to us, that they were reviewing us. But in the very first email, we were accused of publishing false content on Ukraine. Well, we turned the tables on them. I wrote a 9,000-word article responding to their charges against us, in which I show that, in fact, NewsGuard's reporting on Ukraine is false, and they need to make the corrections that they're demanding of us. It's chilling because they will give a red label to websites that they consider to be untrustworthy. This pops up on libraries across Europe and the United States, and every person who buys a computer with Microsoft software in it has this extension built in that they can turn on. And then whenever our website shows up on social media, whether that's Twitter or Google, there'll be this red mark against us, and there's a warning to proceed with caution. This is outrageous, obviously. We have a right even to be wrong. We have a right to say what we want to. This is supposed to be what the freedom of press that the U.S. and European governments protest that they support. And in fact, they're trying to protect their own interests and to cover up any criticism of a legitimate criticism of the failures of their policies. And this is no different than any kind of totalitarian system. I'm sorry, because they want a total control. And the word total is in totalitarian. And I got to bring up Julian Assange here because he is the symbol of this. It started very much with him back in 2020, when they arrested him now and indicted him, even though Biden, when he was vice president, said they could not indict unless there was proof that he actually stole the documents. There is no proof he stole the documents. The main witness has now recanted, saying that Assange had hacked. So there's no evidence against him. They're gone after him because, as any tin pot dictator would do, throwing a journalist in the dungeon because he revealed war crimes, corruption. We're at a very critical and crisis of journalism in the United States when the United States government can get away with doing what they're doing with British connivance against Assange. And now all these moves against independent media like us, it's not just us. Mint Press News also had their PayPal shut. There's only shut down. They only want one narrative on this. This is in line with firing conductors, Russian music conductors and opera singers and tennis players cannot play at Wimbledon. This is part of an extraordinary clampdown on information. And it, by the way, the U.S., in my view, needed Russia to intervene in Ukraine in order to unleash their economic war, in order to unleash their information war, and the proxy war, which they want to go on for a long time. Lloyd Austin said the aim here is to weaken Russia. Joe Biden actually said it, that the aim here is to overthrow Putin. He said on February 24th in his press conference on the day of the invasion that the purpose of the sanctions was never to stop the invasion. It was to bring down Putin. It was to the Russian people to rise up. So they needed this invasion, and part of it is the information war, and we're a small part of the attacks and being targeted on that. They could never have shut down RT. America and Europe has banned RT and Sputnik, whether you agree with them or not. It was the Russian point of view of the news. And they could not have done, and mostly the economic war, the sanctions against the central bank, which are backfiring in the West, and against all the products of Russia that are no longer available, including food and minerals and fuel. This was not possible without this invasion, and I believe U.S. set a trap that Russia walked into, and that was to stir up an offensive in Donbass, and Russia had to decide whether to intervene to try to protect the ethnic Russians there or to let them be slaughtered. And this is the situation right now, though unfortunately there's a long history in the U.S. of this is nothing new. This is a trend going back to John Adams with his Sedition Act, throwing people in jail for what they wrote. And Woodrow Wilson failed by one vote in the Senate from getting official censorship in the Espionage Act, and then he came with his own Sedition Act a year later and threw Eugene Debs and hundreds of people in jail for speeches and articles they wrote. And then, of course, there's McCarthyism. So this is a recurring theme in U.S. history, and we're seeing a very strong example of it right now.
Well, Joe Lurie, I want to thank you so much for being with us, editor-in-chief of the independent news outlet Consortium News, founded in 1995. He's a former U.N. correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, and others, investigative reporter for The Sunday Times of London, now with Consortium News. Thanks so much for being with us. As calls grow for Biden to declare a public health emergency to ensure access to abortion after the Supreme Court overturned Roe, we'll get an update from two leading abortion providers in southern states, including Diane Derzis, CEO of Jackson Women's Health Organization. Yes, that's the clinic at the center of the Supreme Court case that led to the overturning of Roe. Stay with us. By Grace Cummings. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we end today's show with an update on abortion rights, as President Biden considers declaring a public health emergency to expand abortion access after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Biden was asked about the issue Sunday.
One of the things they are asking for is a public health emergency. Is that something you're considering?
That's something I'm asked the folks, the medical people in the administration to look at, whether I have the authority to do that and what impact that would have.
Okay.
Biden's comments came on the same day as some 10,000 reproductive rights activists rallied in Washington to urge the administration and lawmakers to do more to protect abortion.
We're demanding that the federal government do something to legalize abortion now, that waiting till November is not enough.
President Biden signed an executive order Friday to ensure access to abortion medication, abortion pills, and emergency contraception, and is urging Congress to pass legislation to codify abortion rights. On Monday, the Biden administration said that federal law preempts state abortion bans when emergency care is needed, and that the government can penalize institutions or providers that fail to provide abortions as needed to treat medical emergencies. The White House has defended Biden's response to the Supreme Court ruling so far. But one of our next guests tweeted in response, quote, "I don't know who needs to hear this, but here's a free lawyer for after you're arrested isn't really the win for us it's being touted as." That was Robin Marty, operations director of the West Alabama's Women's Center, which used to provide abortion services before the ban and just reopened on Monday. She's also author of The New Handbook for a Post-Roe America. She is in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And joining us in Gulf Shores, Alabama, is Diane Derzis, the CEO and owner of Jackson Women's Health Organization, Mississippi's only abortion clinic, which was at the center of the Supreme Court case that led to the overturning of Roe, Dobbs v. Jackson versus Women's Health Organization. The clinic closed soon after Roe was overturned last month and plans to reopen in Las Cruces, New Mexico, hours away. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Diane Derzis, let's begin with you. You are the woman in charge of the organization that's the named Supreme Court case that overturned Roe. Your response right now, both to the Supreme Court and if you think President Biden is doing enough.
Well, let me address President Biden. I think he is limited in his powers to do anything. I think he's made it clear that unless we turn out for the vote in the next election, we are lost. In the meantime, we are having women flee these hostile states, and we're still threatening doctors, even with what Biden did. We're threatening doctors in neighboring states if they, in fact, give a pill that is taken out of that state and completed at home in a hostile state. So this is far beyond anything that people are talking about at this point. It's dreadful.
Can I ask, why did the Jackson Women's Health Organization close? I mean, it's not only an abortion clinic. It provides all kinds of services. We saw the last day the anti-abortion activists out there. Talk about that decision.
The way that clinic survived was by doing abortions, not by doing the family care and those other, unfortunately, services that we did. Most of those don't pay the rent. And there are other agencies that do those. Our only choice was to go where we could make a difference, and the closest place that we found was Las Cruces. We're still opening in Baltimore, in Virginia, Bristol, Virginia, and we still have clinics in Georgia until we don't. So we do have other places, and we do have inroads into making referrals to women wherever they're closer. And it may not be Las Cruces, but it will be a clinic that's closer to them.
And your decision to pick New Mexico as the best place to operate, could you talk about why? And is there any way that Alabama law can reach out to the work you do there?
I don't see that. It's not a neighboring state. That only, unfortunately, affects the women that are in Alabama. But the reason we picked that was because it is, for the time being, and I say that for the time being, a safe state. We've been welcomed by the governor. It helps when you have someone politically pro-choice who understands women's needs, and women must have these services at any cost. So that is the primary reason we chose New Mexico.
And I wanted to ask you about the Native nations. There's a Choctaw. Mm-hmm. The Choctaw are in Mississippi. Would the Indian reservations have an ability to not follow state law as such?
That's a good question, and one that someone smarter than I would have to answer. We've often thought over the years that the Native Americans, that is their land, whether or not they want to involve themselves in this. It would certainly be wonderful if that were the case, but I think we've talked about it for years. I haven't seen anything or anyone that's ever gotten close to doing anything.
That's really interesting, both Native American reservations and also federal enclaves, right? Federal land in these states, like military bases or other federal land. Let's put that question to Robin Marty, operations director of the West Alabama Women's Center, which has just reopened, interestingly. Explain that decision, though the Women's Health Clinic will not be offering abortions. And then talk about this issue of federal enclaves.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on, first of all. In Alabama, we are a sole clinic. We do not have any other states that we have operations in. We are just specifically in Alabama. We're a nonprofit health center. And so in preparation for Roe being overturned, because we did know it was coming, we set aside a pool of money that we know will allow us to stay open for at least 3 months. And in those 3 months, we're using that in order to build up all of our other programs. So family planning programs, HIV care, prenatal care, PrEP services, all sorts of different programs that we know are desperately necessary in Alabama, because there's no place that people can go to have that. With that pool of money, we are also making sure that we are around so that if a person tries to manage their own abortion, or if a person is having a miscarriage and is afraid to go into a hospital, they're allowed to come and see us, and we can do basic diagnostics, ultrasounds, and help them understand whether they need more care or not, or if they do have a miscarriage and that needs to be managed. We believe that this is the most important thing that can happen in Alabama, because when you criminalize abortion, that means any person who can become pregnant and does have bleeding issues could be suspected of having tried to end their own pregnancy. The state keeps saying that they are not going to charge the person who tries to do their own abortion, but we do know that they will try to charge anyone around that person in order to try and basically make people too afraid to end their own pregnancies. So we are going to be a safe place that does not ask questions and simply sees people with bleeding issues and does what we are legally allowed to under the law. That's why we're staying open. And we are hoping that in the next 3 months, we can raise enough money to keep ourselves open on these new projects. As for all of the questions about federal land or Native land, people need to remember that when it comes to Native lands, I mean, this entire country was Native land. This is land that was stolen from Native Americans, and it is not ours to try to come and say, hey, can we use this in order to circumvent the laws that we as white people have passed, righteously or not, in our own states. Also, when you look at military bases, federal lands, we already know that federally we have the Hyde Amendment, which forbids anyone from doing any sort of taxpayer funding for abortion. We also know that in states that have had their own state versions of Hyde Amendments or have used Hyde Amendments, they've used it to say that anything that is funded by a taxpayer, which would be federal land, counts as federal funding of abortion. So there's simply not an option for us to use federal land, as far as I can tell, in order to set up abortion care centers in these really hostile states.
And Robin Marty, even before the Roe ruling, talk about how it was already difficult to access abortion and reproductive health care in Alabama and the South Gulf Coast.
Very much so. Even prior to the ruling itself, there were only a handful of clinics that are in the Gulf Coast area. There were three in Louisiana, there were three in Alabama, and there was one in Mississippi. That's for the entirety of the region, and we saw exactly how limited that was once Texas banned almost all abortions back in September. And as time has passed, we've seen more and more patients coming from Texas, from Mississippi, from Louisiana, over to our abortion clinic, because it was one of two abortion clinics in the area that was operating 5 days a week. It was impossible for people to get abortions, to even move across the state to get them, because of onerous laws, In Alabama, you had to wait 48 hours between your first in-person appointment and your second in-person appointment. And so that was very difficult for many people who had multiple jobs, children at home. It was already almost impossible to get an abortion, and now it will be virtually impossible. And that's why we're focusing on people that we know are not going to leave the state, because it's simply too hard. There is not enough money that you can give to some of the population in Alabama to allow them to go all the way to Illinois, to North Carolina, in order to access care. We know that they are going to try to access it at home, and it is vitally important to make sure that if they do that, they are able to go somewhere safe where they do not have to worry about surveillance or somebody trying to put them in jail.
Let me go to Diane Dersis and ask you about what's happening in Mississippi, the poorest state in the United States, also has the highest rate of teenage pregnancy and infant maternal mortality. Talk about the effect this ruling is having on Mississippi. We already know that Black maternal mortality is several times what it is for white people who have children, the desperate situation there. And then I wanted to ask you about medication abortions, which is more than half the abortions in the United States, and all that is being done to set up vans along borders to get women these pills, even to perform abortions in the vans. That's a lot there, Diane, but if you could take on that.
Yes, we're actually seeing women travel from Mississippi to our clinic in Georgia right now and to Atlanta, you know, and I happen to disagree with Marty on that. Women will do whatever it takes to get an abortion, whether it be legal, safe, or, as she points out, self-managed. And neither one of those are certainly not the best situation, but we are seeing women travel. There are tons of money that people are putting into the process of making sure women have access for travel and for other reasons. I am not one that supports self-managed abortion, so, you know, it's, are we going to have that? Absolutely. But the medication abortion certainly changed and put a different face on abortion. Again, it does not 100%, so you still have the problems that Robin was speaking of earlier. The whole situation should never have happened. I think that it has to send a message that right now we are trying to plug the bleeding, and the only way to stop this is to absolutely pass federal law that protects a woman's access to the most private decision of her life. And I think that's what we're going to need to do in the long run and to start working on right now. But in the meantime, we're doing everything we can. And you have different ways of doing that, as you've just been pointed out from both of us.
Let me ask Robin Marty if you want to comment on that, and also this division that is growing in the Democratic Party between progressives and the Democratic establishment. Yesterday, the outgoing White House Communications Director Kate Bedingfield saying in a statement, Joe Biden's goal in responding to Dobbs is not to satisfy some activists who've been consistently out of step with the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Your response?
So first to the what Diane had said, I do believe that obviously abortion clinics need to exist, and there are always going to be people who need non-medication abortion. There's also always going to be people who need follow-up abortion care. Medication abortion, as Diane pointed out, is not 100% effective. It's very safe if the pills are gotten from a place that we know is giving verified medication. It's the same medication as in our clinic. But when you have a failed abortion, so one that the abortion did not work, or you have a situation where all of the products haven't come out or bleeding, the reality is that we still need to have places where people can come to, because people are going to do medication abortion out of state, but they are going to come home to finish it. And so once they are at home taking the second dose of their medication, they're now in a place where there is no legal abortion clinic. People are going to need a place to go that will provide that care, regardless of whether they do elective abortion at all. As for the Biden administration's lack of finesse on actually pulling together a coalition. We know that abortion is extraordinarily popular. We know, especially now at the outpouring of the protests that have been happening in D.C., across the country. In Alabama, we've had multiple protests since this decision came down, which has only been a couple of weeks. People want everyone to be able to have action to their own access to their own bodily autonomy. That is a fundamental right, and it's one that the Biden administration has to address because it belongs to everyone and everyone supports it.
Robin Marty, we want to thank you for being with us, Operation Director of West Alabama Women's Center, which has just reopened, and Diane Dersis, CEO and owner of Jackson Women's Health Organization, Mississippi's only abortion clinic, was center of the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe v. Wade. It has closed. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
This summer, I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings, and I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgehaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgehaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Segue.